Welcome you to this morning's session workshop for the Commonwealth Transportation Board. I'm going to ask everyone if you can please stand. We'll say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Get right into the agenda. I'm going to start with Mr. Lawson. Financial report. You got good news for us. For once.
Yes, I'd like to have good news once in a while. Let's see if I can get this one here. As you mentioned, Mr. Secretary, or Mr. Chairman, members of the board, welcome to Richmond again. This morning I do have some good news. The revenues for the state, or transportation revenues, are continuing to grow. When we look at the Commonwealth Transportation Fund revenues through February, we're looking at revenue growth of about 3.6%. which is slightly above the forecasted revenue growth of 3% for this year. Just looking at the types of revenues a little bit, motor fuel tax, which is their largest state sales tax or state tax, is tracking at about 2.9% ahead of last year, which is slightly below the 3.1% that the forecast is expecting. As you know, with the prices of crude going up, there is some uncertainty about where this is headed. You know, we're carefully watching this. Taxation is looking at motor fuels and anticipating that during the summer months we could be looking at fuel prices in the 370 range. But until we do our budget and we forecast based on the official forecast and until tax were to relook at that, we would continue on the path we're on. Motor vehicle fuel sales, those tax collections are really growing. There's been a lot of pent-up demand in the arena of motor vehicle sales. We're looking at tax collections in that arena by almost 15%. These are big numbers. They've been growing now for 16 months straight. Not to downplay that any, though, we're still below where we were in 2002.
Mr. Lawson, just one quick question on that. Is this the actual sales of vehicles that is increasing, or has it been an increase in the rate?
It's volume. The rate hasn't changed.
Okay.
In terms of sales tax collections, we are looking at collections year over year from 2010 in the sales tax area to be about 2.2% above where they were a year ago. This chart just gives you a picture by revenue source of how they are tracking compared to estimate and compared to this year compared to last year through February period. You notice there those the major ones we talked about, motor vehicle fuels, the motor vehicle sales, and the state retail sales and use tax are the big items. The reason you see on this chart that the state sales tax is actually showing as a decrease is because of a timing issue between crossing fiscal years. So that number, when you adjust for that timing act, is actually the 2.2% growth that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, possibly 3.6.
Last month you mentioned liking to have a nice, consistent summary report. You should have at your table a one-page financial schedule that is modeled after. You all see that?
I think it's attached to the back.
Should be attached to the back?
Yeah, the last page.
Very last page?
Yeah.
What that schedule is it's modeled after our financial statements. We do a CAFR each year. This page is a budget comparison sheet that reflects this is purely VDOT based, reflects VDOT's revenues and expenditures. It gives you a comparison of the board-approved budget that you did last June. It shows you what our current operating budget is, with footnotes indicating what the changes are. Most of the changes are related to carry-forwards or a new grant amount that would have been identified since the board approved the budget. Any significant change between programmatic changes or so forth, we come back to the board for those approvals and do a revised budget. So instead of doing a lot of detail in the presentation like I've done in the past, I'll be providing you this one-page financial statement each month. And so from kind of the rest of the presentation, what I'll be doing is just kind of speaking to some observations as they relate to this schedule. Looking at the revenues, we collected $2.2 billion this fiscal year so far. That is $174 million of where we were last fiscal year. And the majority of that, $133 million of it, is related to federal revenue. And this sketch chart you see on the bottom of this slide illustrates the programmatic areas in which that federal revenue is related. And you can see that really it's tied to construction and to the ARRA, the stimulus program, where that additional money has been generated in terms of federal revenue. The ARRA activity alone, we're $80 million ahead of where we were a year ago, as that program is really in full steam now. When I turn to looking at spending, again, this ties to the schedule I showed you earlier, where you see kind of the bottom third of the page where it shows total expenditures. We expended $2.24 billion through February. Almost $200 million ahead of where we were last fiscal year. This does represent about represents the expenditure of 53% of the operating budget through two-thirds of the fiscal year. And when you look at where that spending is, it's probably exactly where you would expect it to be. About three-fourths of the spending is in the maintenance and construction areas. This graphic just gives you a graphical picture of the programs that you see on that financial statement, and it illustrates to you that the growth where it exists really is in those two main areas, construction and maintenance. The other areas, administration is down somewhat, and you can see from the other areas they're pretty consistent with the previous fiscal year. Looking at maintenance a little more closely, we've expended about just over $860 million through February of this year compared to $755 million through February of last year. Most of those increases are, that 14% increase in total is largely seen in the primary area. The increased spending activity, for the most part, is in the areas related to paving and roadside work. $204 million, 24% of the total dollars spent on the maintenance program so far this year were spent on paving contracts. And that's out of about $480 million that we do plan to expend between now or through the full fiscal year. In terms of snow, we have had a little snowier winter than we had hoped. Spent about $165 million through February. It is slightly behind where we were last year, which is a good thing. And it's actually $100 million below where we were in total snow spending for last fiscal year. Turning to construction. Construction spending, including the stimulus program, about $850 million this year. 32% of that spending is focused on the interstate system. And as I mentioned earlier, we've spent $131 million this fiscal year on our projects compared to $51 million that was spent last year. We talked a bit last time about spending on our contracts. This is the same chart that I showed you last month, just updated for March, with the March 1 dated report. And what this you can see is that our contract balances are continuing, our contract amounts as well as balances are growing, especially if you look at the maintenance item on the bottom. That's the line with the X on it. You can see where we've had a pretty significant growth since January, and those are the contracts that we've worked hard to get on the street, and the work should be getting started very soon now, I would expect, on those contracts. To give you a more complete picture of where we are in terms of available contract work, I included this additional slide. The first two bars, the construction and maintenance, reflects the same amount that you saw on the previous slide. What I've also shown here is for our consultant contracts and for our design build PPTA contracts, the value of the contracts and the unexpended balances on those as well. So in total, this represents about $5 billion worth of contracts with uncompleted balances of about $2 billion.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Lano.
Mr. Lawson, on the consultant contracts, notice there's a pretty large chunk of that. Is that as a result of us downsizing staff and increasing the use of consultants? And in this consultant contracts, what does that consist of? What components are part of this? Is it engineering? Is it design?
I think most of these are, I may turn back and look for Mal here, but we have a lot of on-call consultant contracts, and I think that's a large portion of what you see here is we put out the contracts to be able to bring in the consultants to do the design and engineering work.
I certainly appreciate private sector work, and I'd like to see more of it done, but how does that compare with the increase of that side or that component compared to if we reduced our staff, for example, of engineers, so we have to go out and use consultants? What was the cost of the people that we had and the amount of money that was used in that area that we reduced compared to the increase now in the consultants? Are we getting a better deal, or is it a situation where we are finding ourselves spending more money on consultants than if we'd have kept our own engineers in-house?
I understand your question. That's something that I'd have to do some research on. Clearly we have a different complement of staff today than we had before. Our program has changed significantly from before. And again, a lot of these are on-call contracts that may or may not be used over the period of time. So I'll talk with the chief engineer and see if we can hone into that a little bit.
Yeah, it would just help a little bit to know, sure, how that relates to our existing staff. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Lawson, too. This includes contract maintenance consultant work, where we contract out the maintenance work, or is this just professional services?
No, this would reflect all contracts.
So services and actual physical.
Yes.
Okay.
It is both components.
Yes. So it's not just for engineering. It's for any type of person we have on a third-party contract.
Correct. It's all services.
Yeah. Mr.
Chairman,
that's what
the idea is. One at a time. Mr. McCarthy?
Mr. Lawson, if I understood your answer. Consultants, why can't you separate them out into which ones are doing construction work and which ones are doing maintenance work, so we have a clearer picture of how much money we're spending on construction and maintenance?
Well, in terms of consultant contracts, when the contract is put out, especially an on-call contract, you know, it's for a scope of work. And that scope of work could be for a construction project or a maintenance project. So until the work is actually, the task orders are actually put out and the work done, I'm not sure you can separate it and say it's maintenance. It's going to be maintenance or construction.
We have both kinds of contracts. We have on-call contracts that will do maintenance, support the maintenance side of the house. We have contracts that support new construction. So you could take it out. John's right from the viewpoint that you don't know exactly what the work is. Even though, you know, our district, for instance, in Bridge Area, our district bridge engineers, they have on-call maintenance contracts. They can bring people in for bridge repairs and things like that. We have new construction contracts we could do, so you could break it out like that.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Turning to cash, as I've been doing the last couple months now, I continue to show you where we are in terms of cash position. We are continuing along kind of on the path that I've been discussing. You see there we're at $107 million below where we were at the beginning of the fiscal year. And we are continuing to spend down on the maintenance funds as we are working through the year. A big change you see here too is on the very bottom, the CPR bonds, where we have spent down all but $35 million of the bond proceeds. And I'll be talking more about the bond program next. We do fully expect to utilize those funds before the next bond sale.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Lawson, this is one thing I just get into a little bit more, I guess, because of this budget and everything. I'm just curious about terminology. On this chart, you have a concession fund. I know that's not snacks and the rest stop. So, I mean, is this where people have either not performed on time and lost money that way? I mean, given money back, or exactly what does that mean?
No, sir. Mr. Lauterbach, the concession fund is related to their PPTA programs. These concession dollars here are related to the Pocahontas Parkway and the Hot Lanes project, where as part of the deals, they provided a certain amount of cash at closing that were being used for certain aspects of work on those projects.
Okay, thank you.
And just to kind of wrap things up, revenues are continuing to track slightly above forecast. We would like to see them that way. The winter has been a little more costly than we had hoped, but we are moving forward positively. The activity on these new contracts, as I mentioned, we should be seeing get ramped up very soon. We're now into March. I think by April, we certainly should be seeing a lot of, hopefully we'll be seeing a lot of tractors out there putting down asphalt and doing a lot of maintenance and construction activities. We are projecting that the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund will end the year with a cash balance of about $465 million. That is down from about $500 million that we had projected last month as we continue to see some of the increases in the maintenance spending. However, as I've said before and I'll keep reiterating, these balances are very dependent upon how quickly contractors get out and start working this spring. If they delay work until later into the summer, it could have an impact on us in that respect. The construction fund, we are currently forecasting to end the year about $80 million below where we started. We will be kind of taking a new look at the construction program and the construction fund with the introduction of the new bond sale and the infrastructure bank as that is put into place. So we'll be looking at that and probably doing some reforecasting for you for next month. And as always, we'll continue to watch revenues with eager anticipation of continued growth. We'll be watching spending to make sure it's appropriately incurred and progressing as it should, and we'll continue to report to you each month on status.
Any other questions? Mr. Lautenbach?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, one final question on the special revenue fund report, the water summit. We had started off with all the information about the good revenue returns, but I look at this and I want to make sure I understand how that relates. You're seeing that the actuals and then the variance is unfavorable, $1.5 billion. Is that because of the timing of the money coming in, where we haven't gotten some of it yet, or is that, it looks like it, or...
Yeah, most of what you're seeing there is because you're comparing, you know, actual through February to the annual total. So, you know, you wouldn't expect to be through February, have collected everything through February that we anticipate to collect for the full year. So it's kind of a hard comparison to make, but what we're doing is you're showing your actual activity through February as it compares to your budget.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Coulombe?
Mr. Chairman, could you go back to your number 7 slide, which is on maintenance? You know, many of our colleagues on the board have raised this question in the past about the diminishing investment, as a percentage at least, in secondary maintenance. My question is, given that secondary roads are such a large percentage of our total system, does this difference or declining investment by percentage feed back into a planning process that acknowledges the liabilities we're building up by not being more aggressive on the secondary road maintenance now? Or these figures really are just a financial picture and have really nothing to do with the planning cycle?
Well, I mean, clearly what you're seeing here is a financial picture, but I think it's also reflective of the time of year. You know, and how the program has progressed through the first half of the year. I would anticipate that during the latter portion of the fiscal year, you will see additional activity. From a pure planning perspective, you can see what was anticipated to be spent. You know, $420 million on secondary maintenance compared to $400 million that was planned to be spent last fiscal year. So that there is a intended plan to spend more this fiscal year than last.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Richard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Is somebody going to give us a little overview of what happened in the General Assembly, the final figures, that type of thing?
Yeah, I'm surprised we didn't put on a...
spending today.
Well, the budget's not final. I mean, the changes to the budget. Right. But we should have put on at least a roundup of the General Assembly session. We'll have to do it next month.
Or could somebody send something out?
Sure.
I'm getting inquiries from taxpayers and the media, and I just kind of like having a little fact sheet. As to what, how much was, I forget how much is in the infrastructure bank.
For that?
Something. The additional funds that we're getting, right, because of the subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody can give us a rundown on that, just so we have that at hand, it would be helpful, I think.
Yeah, we can do it at the end of the workshop agenda.
Mr. Secretary, we had actually planned for next month to brief the board, and the reason is the governor has a certain time period in which to amend or veto legislation, and we wanted to wait till the governor had been through the process when all the bills had been signed.
He's not going to veto his transportation bill, is he?
No.
Okay. Well, if you could give us something, that would be helpful.
We are going to make amendments to the bill.
Okay.
All right, so we're starting to make progress on the balances, but we do have a longer-term plan to get our balances.
Yes.
Okay.
We are making progress on getting our balances down, particularly the cash balances. And you can see that through the chart where you can see where we put more maintenance work out on the street. And as John indicated, we're pretty confident that our contractors will start work early in the spring, and we should start seeing those cash balances fall. We expect not to get our balances to where we want them, though, until the end of FY 12. Okay. So FY 11 will still be higher than what we want, June 30th, 11, but because the contracts that we're issuing in January and February of this year, they really go through the fiscal year. So we'll see some of the work starting in March, you know, ending September, October of 11. And then we'll start a cycle over again. So I think it'll be FY 12 before you really see the balances down where we would like them to be.
Yes, Ms. Lane.
I've had a chance with Mr. Greg to go through the stuff and understand, but I've never been in a business where I had a hard time spending cash. I know we've got a plan and working on it, but you know, it just seems to me that that's something that we can continue to work on.
Yes.
Get my wife up here.
Well, one other thing there too is that just because we have the money, I hope that, and I certainly feel that we are watching the projects, and from what I gathered earlier with the economy, a lot of these projects are coming in less anyway, so we should be able to get more projects done. And I know there's a certain amount of paperwork done, but we just can't throw the money out without carefully watching it as well, because we need to, these times, and taxpayers watching, we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can. So
that's correct.
I feel like we're probably doing as good as we can, keeping the controls that we need to keep.
I'll come back.
I have an interest in knowing more about the types of contracts that we might be letting to do this secondary maintenance. I know we're behind as compared to before, but just getting some examples and looking at ways that we might be doing maintenance to secondary system, because there's fewer and fewer dollars that have been available to that system. And as a side and support of what Mr. Koolame has indicated, you know, the lack of that maintenance really appears to be building up some liabilities for us in the future as far as failure of roadways. Instead of actually having the money to patch, we're probably going to have to tear up some asphalt to make it safe if we don't maintain what we've got out there. One of the areas that is of interest to me, and I've noticed in a lot of the rural areas, is there's a lack of proper drainage maintenance, which causes additional damage to our infrastructure by the fact that we're not keeping the water off of it. And so I'm just interested in that area and seeing what we're doing, and as an aside, to see if we have, and we know we're not adequate, but do we have a plan to try to get as close to adequate as we can?
Next CTB meeting, we can do more of a presentation on the maintenance related to the
secondary. That'd be great.
Mr. Karczynski?
Yes, Mr. Secretary, as a corollary to Mr. Lauterbach and Mr. Lane's observations, I think what we have to watch closely is the industry response. How quickly can they gear up? Because you have to remember, although we have the money to spend, the heavy construction industry is still looking at a very tentative recovery. So I think that's a number that we have to watch, Aubrey, what you were talking about. How fast can we spend and how fast can they really gear up? It's not going to be all out just because we have a little bit more money.
Well, I clearly think that's the case, because if you look at the bar graphs, left the contracts, they just haven't got them done. That's why I was encouraging to the extent there are other opportunities. But I think that's exactly it. What's happening.
Anyone else? Ms. Lawson, thank you very much. Let's talk about CPR bonds.
Moving on to CPR bonds. This is touching a little bit on the governor's plan you mentioned earlier. This month, this afternoon on the action item, I'll be coming to you at looking for authorization to sell CPR bonds. what I wanted to do this morning is to kind of give you an overview of the CPR bond program, how the program was, I guess, put into place, what its intended purpose is, and kind of give you the outline of how we're planning to use these funds to support the transportation program. The CPR bonds were authorized by Chapter 896 in 2007, referred to most of the time as HB 3202, which authorized $3 billion worth of sale of bonds. The $3 billion was to be used as outlined in the bill, or in the chapter, 20% to be used for transit capital, a minimum of 20% for transit capital, a minimum of 4.3% to be used for rail capital, and then the balance was to be used to provide federal match, to enhance the revenue sharing program, and then as funds were available for statewide and regional projects. The original legislation limited the sale to $300 million a year and permitted the carryover of any unsold amount, so that if you only sold $200 million versus $300 million one year, you could carry that 100 over and add it to the three and sell $400 million the following year. In 2009, the authorization was increased by $180 million to a total of $3.18 billion. That was done to replace $180 million of general funds, which were provided in 2007 and then taken back as part of the general funds budgeting actions. The first sale of the CPR bonds was done last May, totaling $493 million. The governor's plan this past year, his omnibus funding bill, House Bill 2527 and Senate Bill 1446, did not seek to increase the authorization of the CPR bond amount. What the bill sought was to accelerate the sale of the bonds to allow us to sell $1.8 billion over a period of 3 years. This fiscal year, this May 2011 sale will be the first of the three $600 million planned issues. There's actually enough unissued amounts from prior years to support this first $600 million sale. What the governor's bill sought for and as it was engrossed does provide for increases in the annual sales limits in fiscal years 12 and 13 to support the sale of $600 million in each of those 2 years, which would then get us to our $1.8 billion objective. And the whole purpose here is to take advantage of the current climate with relatively low prices and interest rates and to get the projects on the street and get them moving now when market conditions are more favorable than they're likely to be in the future. In terms of how the authorization is being used, I explained earlier how the bill authorization actually laid out the intended use of the bonds. This chart just kind of breaks out and shows you the details of how they are intended to be used. We will be using bonds in some form, at some level, through the fiscal year 2020 in the planning process. You see over the life of the authorization, the full 20%, $600 million going to capital. You see the shares there for rail portion being used for match. And the big change that really is coming out of the acceleration is the amount that you see there listed at project funding, that $1.1 billion. The extra $180 million I mentioned earlier is specific to rail and transit projects as they were outlined in the previous legislation when the general funds were described.
So none of this goes to maintenance, right?
Correct.
Right.
As I mentioned, the first sale was done last May, and the proceeds, that $493 million sale, was used to reimburse VDOT and DRPT for bond-related costs that we'd actually incurred prior to the sale. As we've mentioned, the bill, the authorization went in place in 2007, and we actually started programming and planning the use of those funds in 2008. So there was a significant amount of liability incurred that was used to kind of paid off once we sold those first bonds. The 2011 sale, $600 million, will also be used to reimburse for additional bond-related expenditures that have been incurred and have not been provided for at a bond proceeds since we have not sold but that one sale amount, as well as we plan to have enough proceeds from this sale to fund both VDOT and DRPT cash flow needs as it relates to the bond programs throughout the fiscal year 2012 until the next sale a year from now. This sale that we look to do in May, combined with the subsequent sales in 2012 and 13, do comprise the $1.8 billion that was, the single largest component of the governor's 2011 funding plan. That, along with the garbage that we are planning to sell, will be used to advance and accelerate the construction program, and will be used to support the projects that are many of the projects that are included in the illustrative project list that you've all seen, and will obviously be funded through your actions with the adoption of the 12 through 17 six-year improvement program later this year. In terms of the debt service, just a little information as to how debt service is handled on the CPR bonds. The debt service on the CPR bonds is provided by dedicated revenues to the Priority Transportation Fund. The largest component of that revenue is the one-third of the taxes on insurance premiums. There's also a small portion of the state motor fuel tax that is provided to the PTF that was attributable to the change in taxation at the RAC, estimated at $20 million by the Department of Taxation. And the fund does retain its interest earnings. The actual PTF revenues last fiscal year was $152 million. And when we look out over the period between now and fiscal year 2017, we're estimating that the amount available annually for debt service to be $225 million. And that does include, we mentioned this before, last fiscal year 10, in the revenues of the HMO and the TTF were above forecast. And as part of the Chapter 896, the authorization for the CPR bonds, it requires any revenue in excess a forecast within the HMO and the transit and construction components of the TTF to be deposited into the Priority Transportation Fund. So we have $50 million of revenues from that purpose that we can use to supplant the annual revenue stream to support the debt service over the long period as we look to sell the full $1.8 billion over the three-year period of time. So when we look at that period, we're looking at an average debt service of about $176 million. So clearly the $225 is more than adequate to cover that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McCarthy.
What are the maturity dates anticipated for these bonds?
The CPR bonds are 25-year notes.
25 years.
In terms of schedule, today I'll be coming back in your action meeting looking for your approval for us to proceed with the bond issue. We would then move forward to an April 20 meeting with the Treasury Board to seek their approval. And from there, our schedule has a planned date of competitive sale on May 11th with a planned close date on May the 25th. And just kind of summarizing it, You see here that of the $3.18 billion that we have authorized, we sold $493, planned to sell $600 million in May, which would leave about $2.1 still remaining to be sold over the next 10 years. Yeah.
Any questions for Mr. Lawson?
Chairman?
Mr. Richard?
I forgot. What does PTF mean?
It's the Priority Transportation Fund.
What was that?
Priority Transportation Fund.
How is that different from the other transportation funds?
The PTF was created as part of the authorization in 2007, and its purpose was to provide funding, specific funding, to support priority projects. It was tied into the long list of projects that was in. It goes all the way back years when we had the long list of projects in 2002. It was to be a funding source. In 2007, its main focus was dedicated to paying for debt service on supporting debt.
So it's outside of the regular formula?
It's totally outside of formula and is intended purely to be a financing mechanism to support debt service at this point.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Garzinski.
Mr. Chairman, I was just talking to John on the side about acronyms that are used all the time, and I would find it, as a newcomer to the board, to our advantage as newcomers, a glossary of these acronyms, because we're not veterans of all these ABCs that get thrown around.
That's the Alcohol
Garbage,
Beverage Control
like
Board.
So I would ask staff, maybe could do that.
Okay. You didn't get the tattoo with all these on? We'll make sure we schedule that for the next meeting. Yeah, Ms. Lane, if we could just get that for me, yes.
I was a little flipping early. I'm going to relate this back to my maintenance remark, because we've become, thank goodness we have the borrowing, because otherwise we're a federally funded program. All our revenues, pretty much, because our state monies are going to maintenance and now debt retirement and the operations of our facilities. So I'm preaching to everybody, you don't use the money, you're going to lose it. And that's the issue I had with the maintenance, because we're going to be getting a letter, the board will, from Hampton Roads, the business community, about the around the tunnels, the way the condition of the pavement is and what have. So we're having businesses saying, you know, they're not going to compete anyway. That was really my point with this, is that we are becoming a competitive. We don't have any more formulas. I mean, it's competitively based, these projects listing. And so from a credibility standpoint, that's really where I was trying to get to, because that's what I have been telling the other people in the localities and the TPO there. That either we got to be accountable, either we spend these monies on the projects or we're going to lose it. In that regard. So that's really what my point was about. Then I have a personal question. Are we allowed to buy these bonds, or are we precluded out as members of the CTB?
Where's our lawyer? Where's our
lawyer? The bonds are sold competitively, you know, to it, and they'll be purchased by usually a major security broker.
This has actually come up before with board members. And normally you buy bonds in a street name. You don't buy the bonds that
right.
personally to you. So because of that, you don't have the conflict, because you don't have a contract, right?
So as long as it's through the broker or street name, it's no issue.
Great investment, Mr. Lane.
I think
great
it is.
Investment.
I think it might be. I think it would show confidence, too.
Any other questions?
1% in a bank account. That's about 0.7%. I can assure you.
Well, we'll just sell you the whole $600 million if you like.
I thought I was more like in the 10,000 range. And that
Mr. Peake?
I want a sidewalk. I'm just kidding.
It isn't not necessarily for Mr. Lawson. I don't want to keep you standing up there all day, but perhaps the Secretary Commissioner. And it's come up in my district, and you referred to the priority transportation funding, and that does not follow the formulas or the funding formulas. And it came up in one of these blue presentations last meeting, and Dr. Davis brought it up, I believe. And in essence, is there anything that's going to go through the funding formulas in the near future?
It all depends on revenues. It all depends on the revenues. And obviously, being 0.6% above what our projections were, we're not going to have enough revenues to send it through.
And so only only revenues that the state generated at the state level for construction go through the funding formula.
Generally.
And we have very little revenue at this point. Is that
That's correct? Right.
And so until revenues are increased through some source, there will be no money to go through the funding formulas.
Yes.
And then whatever money we're spending, however we raise it, is at the discretion of VDOT, the commissioner.
For the bonds?
Whatever, wherever the money comes from, priority transportation funding, bonds, whatever we've got, federal funds, whatever.
6-year plan.
Well, it's at the discretion of this board.
This board.
But obviously, which was one of the reasons when we circulated, we went out to the board to begin with for this package on the trying to accelerate the bond sales of the Garveys as well as the infrastructure bank. We went out and looked to you all for ideas and what projects. For that specifically, we had various criteria which you all received and hopefully was used to guide your decisions or suggestions as to what to put into the...
And that was based on projects ready to go.
That's right. Projects to, again, take advantage of the low prices and the better interest rates that we're seeing today.
But going forward,
yeah,
just this year, next year, but 5-10 years down the road, mm-hmm. unless there's increased revenue from some source, the funding formula is going to remain?
That's exactly right. One thing I just will mention is that by accelerating many of these projects, either pulling some projects forward that were in the end years of the 6-year plan, or ones that have fallen off the table completely, we're going to have a little bit more leeway now in the 6-year plan, okay? Because there are a good number of those projects that were in that 900 project list that have been pulled forward, which is going to create additional capacity. But the bottom line is that the funding formula itself, unless there's a dramatic increase in the revenues going into the TTF, and or we stop the transfers from the TTF over the HMOF, because right now, you know, last year we moved almost $500 million from the construction fund that could have gone down. If we had were able to stem that transfer, that money would have gone down and actually would have funded the formula.
And that was from construction funds to maintenance funds.
That's right. And maintenance obviously does not fall under the
and was that voted on by this board?
Yes, you did.
And at the request of?
It's our
well, by law, we must do maintenance first.
So we really didn't have much choice on it.
That's
we?
Correct.
That is by law.
Yeah. Dr. Davis.
And related to this conversation, I tried to follow, but I'm not sure I saw any action out of the legislative session that dealt with the issue of funding that might help us start planning to have shovel-ready projects. Was there much discussion or recognition of the fact that some state money is going to be needed to get projects ready to go, or we're going to eventually run out of shovel-ready projects if we don't put a fairly substantial sum of money into planning to bring a lot of the projects along? I was just curious if that got into the debate or not.
The issue is it was brought up quite a bit. I mean, we I think, we outlined to them the various challenges we're facing, and the commissioner and obviously had come to the board last year and setting aside $80 million a year at least to start to do project development work, specific project development work, and similar numbers will be in, you're likely going to come forward on in this update to the 6-year plan. So that is an issue. I bet that, you know, that did come up in various hearings that we participated in, where there was concern that by us moving all these projects that were, quote unquote, more shovel ready, what would that mean to the out years? And we've made commitments that we will clean up the project development process to make sure that we're ready to go with projects. But it still doesn't get back to the other problem of making sure the revenues
are there.
Yeah. And you know, again, the governor's made statements over and over again regarding this issue that this is the first bite at the apple. This is to take, you know, this is to put an immediate infusion of funds into the program that we will be back next year.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Along the same line of conversation, is do we feel that we have sufficient staff in-house to review all the projects in order to address, like, Mr. Lane's comments about getting the projects out and all? I mean, do we feel like we have enough? Or along the line, could we look at some of the consultants that are maybe on board, on call, so to speak, using some of them to help us move some of the projects with a type of compensation so that they are also watching the dollars and are encouraged to watch the dollars closer? The point being is that we can maybe get more of them generated quicker. And I was just wondering, do we feel confident that we have enough on board already that we don't need to do that?
I'll let the commissioner.
Yes, we have, with our staff that we have, plus using consultants, we are using them to get projects ready so we can get those out quicker. The chief engineer and I were discussing that, and we do have some on-call consultant contracts that can help us actually get our packages ready for procurement sooner. And then we will start doing that right away. So we are using the consultants and the staff to get these packages ready. And then once these projects start, we also use a combination of our in-house staff and consultants to actually monitor the projects themselves once they start a construction.
Although, but I should add, I mean, one of the things I beat up on the commissioner and the deputy commissioner about is the processes. It's obviously the processes that VDOT followed when it was an organization of 11,500 have to be different for an organization that right now is only hovering around 7,000. And the levels of oversight and review and over-review means that VDOT on these projects has to really, really dramatically change how it reviews projects. The commissioner has already taken some steps with the senior leadership to do that. To bring in a consultant, right? Are you doing
yes.
the process? You might want to just mention that.
We took the audit report that was done by Cherry Beckett and Holland, and they had recommendations on project delivery. They had recommendations in the maintenance area, recommendations in the administrative area. And the common thread through those different areas were processes. Do you have the right business processes in place to move the program forward and to do it efficiently? So we have a group in-house that's called our Safety and Performance Management Division. They're somewhat our in-house consultants, and I've tasked them with looking at a number of these business processes, and we're trying to streamline those processes such that we can get our projects out quicker. The chief's actually involved in that as well. We're looking at the oversight of projects on the field, and we tier those projects. There's a tier one project, tier two project, how much oversight are needed on those individual projects. So we're going through that process. We're actually looking at our procurement process related to consultants as to can we shorten that process. In the audit, if you recall, it said it took approximately 7 to 12 months to get a procurement done, and we're trying to streamline that process down so we can substantially shorten that period. Some of that is related to staffing. And that's the reason I mentioned we will be using consultants to help us shorten that that process of preparing our procurement packages. We've also tasked KPMG just recently to help us look at some of our programming and planning processes that we've that we have in the department, to help us look at those business processes to determine can we streamline those processes, which activity adds value, which activity does not add value, and what item needs to be done in the field versus what item that needs to come to the central office. We've tasked them, KPMG, to actually have just started this week to look at that process. So we have a number of things on the table now in terms of looking at our business processes. It's going to take time, but I'm confident that we're going to streamline many of those processes.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to follow on that, saying that I commend you for that, because as the expression goes, time is money. And if we are putting roadblocks or red tape in the way, then I think we need to try to streamline as much as possible to get it out, especially with the good conditions we have economically right now to get the procure projects. So that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and, the commissioner knows of some recent examples of delays in awarding contracts, and it's just because, it's smaller staff, that they've done it the way they've always done it, and you sit there and go, we can't be doing it like that anymore. And as the commissioner is taking steps to address all this. Mr. Lane?
Just one final comment on that. I think it's more than just efficiency. To get to where the governor, I believe, wants to get to, and that is the next step with revenues, we've got a great opportunity here. They've given us some monies to show that we're good stewards, but also efficient. The public sees that we're doing this, and I see how we perform from here out as being a big component of if we're able to get more revenues, whatever form they may take, because of the political will necessary. So that's another reason for the questions, I think, is to, there's a lot at stake here.
Well, and just to go along with that, Ms. Lane, I think that I think it's very, very true, even regarding this package that we were able to get through, and the fact that we were able to get through, I think, 47, 48 bills out of 54 that we introduced, and it's because they actually do see that we are addressing a lot of what were real and perceived concerns. And that we intend to get these projects out as quickly as possible. So, the more that they see that we're doing, I think, and this is what the governor has been pushing, is we can't go back and ask for additional money until we can show that we're using effectively and efficiently the money that we have. And that's what, and I do think you've seen that very clearly, that message from the General Assembly this session. Any other questions, Mr. Richard?
Just two quick questions. One on personnel, and this relates to our being responsive to our customers, the taxpayers. I think there's a new policy where if you call the residency or you call the district office, you don't get that. They sent you down. I didn't have my Rolodex.
Salem.
So they sent me to some nice lady in Southwest Virginia. Mm-hmm. I was calling the Northern Virginia office. And it was like trying to get through the Wizard of Oz. And I'm worried that may be penny wise and pound foolish. I mean, we've got to make our people available. I mean, if they get a crank that's calling them all the time, they know how to avoid the call, I'm sure. But I think we need to re-examine that. So when you call the district office, you don't get somebody from way away. Maybe the next step will the calls will be being answered in India or something. We don't want to get to that situation.
The Commonwealth of Virginia will not move its call center to India.
That's good. But anyhow, I think we need to re-examine that, because I don't know how much we're saving, but it can't be that much. And I think our responsiveness to the taxpayers is important. They're our main customers. They're paying the bill. The other thing I had was on maintenance money. Do we have a special little pot set aside for potholes? I can tell you about one I hit coming down.
Did you call that 1-800-4-ROADS? 1-800-4-ROADS.
Do we have a special program going on for potholes?
I believe it's just simply. Go ahead.
We do have a line item for repairs for the potholes and. But in reference to the customer service center, we've just started that. There are some very successful models out in the private sector of how you use call centers as a way to have one place where the customer can call, and that we are then able to send that work order out to the appropriate site to actually get the work done. So we're still working on it, and we're still trying to make improvements to it. I'm not certain it's been up quite a year yet, or close to it, but we're still making improvements on it. But we will take the comments to heart and take a look at it and make certain we're being responsive. But having that call center does save us money. Because we're able to focus those calls in one place versus having them throughout the 180 area headquarters.
But I'm getting some complaints, you know, from taxpayers about that. You know how frustrating it is if you call the phone company and you can't get a response. But I thank you for looking into that. Are we doing anything special for potholes this year, or are we just doing our normal thing? Or?
We're doing our pothole blitz right now.
Pothole blitz too.
Pothole blitz too. Son of pothole blitz.
I think they're always on 66. That's why John doesn't get any on 95.
No, I hit one on 95. Not 66.
That's to really keep people awake on that road.
Yeah. Sure.
But this year, actually, on 66, you're going to see $50 million of paving. $60 million of paving this year.
Yep.
Then you're going to call up that 1-800-4-ROADS and complain about all the traffic because of the paving going on. That's a good thing. All righty. So awesome. Thank you very much. Mr. Estes, revenue sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. More members of the board. If I could, Mr. Chairman, before I jump into revenue sharing, if you would allow me to talk about transportation enhancement just very briefly. Just want to make sure that the board members knew that you have one packet in front of you today going through our normal process. We've worked with the district members, and I want to thank the district representatives for working with either your district administrators or with my staff on the tentative selections. And we'll reach out to the at-large members very shortly to schedule something, hopefully in April, to work through those selections as well. So I just wanted to and acknowledge that before I jump into...
Mike, just tell Shep that because he missed this meeting, he's not getting his L.
I'll ask Mr. Lane to communicate that message.
He's in Cabo. I'll be happy to get it to him.
All right, switching gears, sir, if I could jump to revenue sharing. Again, the enhancement side, not to confuse them, is the federal program that is for non-motorized type improvements. Revenue sharing is that state-funded, kind of state-funds-only program that we've been talking about quite a bit. And just want to give you a quick update and talk to you about some aggressive plans we have with the program based on the General Assembly changes that happened recently and what we expect to see. I won't go into great detail on the first couple slides. You've seen this before. You know, if it was a reminder back last fall, we set out a tentative request for letters of intent. You can see the interest that we got back last fall, and summarizing the next slide on the table. Basically, we saw a response for about $45 million worth of requests before the General Assembly session came into town. The big news was the legislative changes that came out of the session, or we expect to come out of the session, paralleled to, again, the Governor's transportation plan and the large bills that Mr. Lawson referenced earlier. The big highlight, again, was increasing the opportunity to bring funds to the program. Prior to that, we had a maximum of $50 million per year. As you heard last month, the anticipated allocation for FY12 is still at the $50 million level. It also allows localities to request up to $10 million now. The prior maximum was $1 million, and we'll talk about that a little bit more here in just a minute. The tiers, which I know a lot of you had heard about before, those were actually stricken out of the law and basically says that priority will be given to projects that accelerate projects in either the six-year improvement program or a locality's capital improvement program. And the reason I'm in front of you especially today is that it also specifies that the CTB is going to play a more, I'd say, extensive role in the guidelines on how these funds are allocated. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Escape.
Mike, the anticipated FY12 allocation of $50 million is based on, what's it based on? Is it?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, I believe the initial base was, you know, on the previous letters of intent, we had under $50 million. So I believe that's why Mr. Lawson has budgeted that $50 million for FY12.
Is it possible, Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Davis,
to take a look at that and consider an adjustment?
Sure. Yes? No? How much?
Well, I think it. I think that the difficulty, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Davis, will be on timing. And we're going to aggressively move out with the formal application call immediately and see what we get from a formal response with the new changes.
Yeah.
So we're not exactly sure what the dollar amount is going
to
be.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not suggesting we try to set an amount that's unreasonable, but I think this program is so effective that if we got 100 million requests, I think we ought to, and we have 200 million authorization, we ought to seriously consider trying to fund as much of that as possible. That's my only thought.
Yeah, no, and this was the intent of it. The problem we're going to face is one of the reasons we were asking for these letters of indication early, so was that in the development of the six-year plan, we could end up setting aside that pot of money for that. The problem we're going to face is, of course, July 1st, the new changes would go into effect.
Yes, sir.
Which would be passed when we'd end up passing the six-year plan. And I think we would take a look at it, but my recommendation would be we stick with the $50 million because it's right, we got $45 million in letters of indication.
Yes, sir, about $46 million.
And then for the next six-year plan is really truth it much earlier, essentially get much stronger, develop a process that for the next six-year plan we can actually go to the full 200.
The only suggestion, Mr. Chairman, I certainly would defer to you and the staff for knowing what might be the best approach as far as meeting the deadlines, but being able to fund more than $1 million, when you look at the project, yeah, if they come in and the locality's putting up $2 million on a $5 million project, I would think in some cases it might be wise to look at our allocation and make some adjustment. But I agree that probably taking it to $100 million without knowing what the requests are might be difficult.
Well, I mean, nothing said. I mean, we'll still have the final trigger, I mean, or decision on it.
Mr. Chairman.
I mean, it is this issue about maybe trying to get the indications with the higher limit, per project limit, and seeing what's available, and then we'll have to make a decision when we get closer. Yes, Mr. Keating.
Even at the $50 million, we don't have indications that we're going to have applications that would rise to the level of $50 million. So there's a question in my mind, it's such a great program with a potential of $400 million going into projects out there. Much of it is redoing some secondary roads where we really need, where there's no money coming, we really need help. I know we have to have an oversight, but this is a reimbursement program. And I have heard some rumblings, if you will, from the localities on, you know, it's real difficult to do this project and put all this money up front, wait for reimbursement, and then have difficulty in getting some of your funds reimbursed. And so I think there's been some that have had the grumblings of slow payments and so forth. I just wondered if we need to take a look at this to in some way enhance that part of it in administering the funds, and maybe even consider the fact like up front 25% award to get this project moving. I know we have to have oversight now. It wouldn't require that much more oversight to just go ahead and advance 25% of the contract, certainly tied to some type of reimbursement agreement and so forth. And maybe at some phases of it, advance another 25% at 50% completion and so forth, but holding back making sure that we don't just grant all the money and let them spend it. But I think there's an enhancer here that we could utilize by getting these some money into these people's hands, and they could move the project forward a little quicker. Because it's difficult to raise some money out there in some of these counties sometimes, and people want to take advantage of this, and they just can't twist it out of their budget. So I think if we take a look at that, we might enhance this program even more.
Ms. Testes, how much of that is statutory versus our policy?
Mr. Chairman, the difficulty is we handle the finances a little different depending on whether the locals are doing the projects themselves or whether VDOT's doing the project. If VDOT's doing the project, we do require the locals to send us the money up front. And I don't know if that's what Mr. Keene is concerned about, is we're requiring that full match up front before we begin the project. And I think we could look at, especially as we grow the matching requirement, our primary focus is to make sure we can pay our bills if we're administering the project and we have that cash flow in hand. So we can look at that, I think. Now, when it comes to a locality administering the project, they simply just, they do spend the money, and then they have to provide the match. So they bill us basically for half the work. It's a 50-50 type program. So they'll spend $100, they'll bill us for $50, and that type of thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Garzinski.
Michael, I have a question for you. Once the governor signs off on the program next month, will there be a new letter going out to the localities telling them, hey, here's some new criteria, this is what you can do now to prompt more applications?
That's a great question, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Garzinski. Our plan, depending on kind of how the rest of this conversation happens, is I plan to send them a letter today or tomorrow. And like I said, aggressively try to move forward to having something for the board in May so you'll know where we stand on requests.
Yeah, because, you know, going back to your point, I mean, the universe of projects go up potentially exponentially when you look at $10 million per project versus $1 million. And actually, I personally, the $10 million per project is great because you can get some real projects done. So let's just see where it is. I mean, I it's going to be difficult for the commissioner and for Mr. Lawson and Ms. Buescher to kind of put this all together because, you know, you all are already working on the six-year plan and how everything's going to fit. So let's see how quickly you get some indications.
Yes, we'll talk timeline a little bit more in just a second, too.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a good opportunity for the commissioner and Mike to look at this, too, and the staff, to figure out how to help get money out and take advantage of the low rates and the low costs right now.
Yeah, the only thing is that, I mean, obviously, as you know, I mean, we want to get the money out, but it also then, the money that we use for this comes out of other potential projects.
Yes.
But we definitely want, I mean, this is the whole reason we wanted some of these. We originally wanted to have this program unlimited, but the General Assembly did not support that.
I think that's the key point, Mr. Chairman, that you're making, too, is wherever the board decides on the allocation, it's basically kind of somewhat of an off-the-top allocation, so something other program would have to then be reduced accordingly. I think that's been some of the discussion in the debate.
I think that's my intent.
Yes. So.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Rector.
Are these projects 100% secondary and 100% urban, essentially?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rich, I would say the high percentage is going to be secondary and urban. There are, on a few occasions, where a locality may decide that it's a priority to put something on a primary or something else. I think they have that flexibility. But I'd say the lion's share is going to be a local road network type stuff.
Yes. Ms. Coleman.
Ms. Justice, can you give us some indication broadly of what the local match of this is? You've given us what is expected from VDOT, $45 million. Is it equal to $45 million, or is it more than $45
million? Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coulomb, it will be at least that $45, $46
million.
Usually they're going to, it depends on the project and also the cost. Sometimes localities are going to have to put in more than that to make sure that project comes to fruition. So it's we'll know. When we bring the formal approval in June, I can give you the exact number because that number will be on the application from the local governments. Okay, if I could I'd say the biggest thing I would like to have a little bit more conversation with the board is going to be this next slide. I know it's a lot of text, but It really deals with the guidelines that we're going to be hopefully bringing back to the board. That's, again, the new change in legislation has asked the board to create guidelines. And really this, there'll be other things in the guidelines, but I believe this is the meat right here. And this is about how we approach a scenario where we have, say, $50 million allocated, but we have more than those in requests and so forth. And it's our proposal to the board that we fund all the allocations that we can up to the initial $1 million first before we consider funding allocations above the $1 million. And I would just quite frankly tell you that some of that is to protect some of the smaller communities around the Commonwealth to make sure that they get a crack at the pot first before we get into some of those bigger projects. So the plan would be to, we'd look at the request up to $1 million. We've adjusted our application that we'll be sending out to our local governments. We'll basically look at what can, they'll be providing us information with what can you do up to $1 million, and then if you want more than that, what can you do with that $1 million to $10 million range. So we'll have that information to present to the board. So I won't go into that with any great detail, but that's the nuts and bolts of the intent and what we'll be presenting to you. That'll be the major change in the existing guidelines. And then when we get to the requests over $1 million, we'll be looking at, obviously, the legislative mandate that says we'll be prioritizing those projects that the locals say they can accelerate that are in the six-year plan or the capital program. And quite frankly, we're looking for the locals to tell us that they can deliver these projects over a short turnaround. We don't want to get into another situation where we're putting a lot of funds on projects that may be sitting for years. So we're looking for that in the application process as well. And depending on the dollar amount of the allocation, the number of requests we get over that $1 million, we'll putting some latitude in the guidelines that we could come to the board with a staff recommendation for how to address that. Traditionally, we have prorated all requests equally, and sometimes that ends up spreading a little bit of money over a lot of projects. So we want some of that flexibility. I want to have that discussion with the board at that appropriate time.
Mr. Chairman, that's where I'd like to add to have the discussion as well about the possibility of adding some money to the program if it's feasible.
Yeah.
That would go hand in hand.
Mr. Chairman.
Carson.
Michael, I have one concern I have about the $1 million versus the $10 million. If because of the definition of some roads in the Commonwealth as secondary as opposed to what they should be, are we getting as much traffic relief or traffic advancement by precluding the bigger projects where they're really needed just for the sake of equity? Perceived equity, I'll say. That's a concern I have with our responsibility as trying to make the Commonwealth's transportation system as efficient as it can be.
That's the heart of the argument.
Yeah.
It is the argument. I don't know that I probably want to answer the question, Mr. Gazinski, directly, but I think it is some of the debate we want to hear from the board.
We need to have that discussion, in all fairness, to everyone on the board.
Yeah, the approach in front of you is to ensure equity amongst the Commonwealth, amongst the local governments who are able to come up with some allocation. I'll give you examples. There are some localities across the Commonwealth that would love to participate in this program, but quite frankly, they want to put up $150,000 a year. And that's all they can put up. And we're trying with this approach to make sure that county, that rural county can get that $150,000.
As Mr. Keene, I think, was pointing out. Okay.
Yes.
So I can buy that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sessies, anything else?
Yes, sir. Timeline, real quick.
Before you leave that aside, it says that we will be review criteria for additional funding. Is there a process where we're going to establish some guidelines here that we need to have some input on? And what's that process going to be like tonight?
Great segue, Mr. Keene, to the next slide. What we're going to do is we're going to put the meat of what you saw in that previous slide in a set of guidelines, and we're going to email that to you by April 1st. And what we're going to do is come to you back in the April board meeting and hopefully ask you to adopt those guidelines. Because, again, we're going pretty aggressively because we want to put the call for applications out now so we can try to get this on board with our process for the beginning of fiscal year 12. We want to put that money in the locals' hands as soon as possible. So.
Pursuant to that, when you put out those guidelines, can you then share back to the board the consensus comments of the people so we know what our brethren are saying before we come to the April meeting about this criteria? I'm interested to find out
you know, what Mr. Lauterbach and Mr. Keene said about the criteria and not find out about it the day before we come back in April, so we can start to build a consensus.
Mr. Kaczynski, I think we can easily do that. It will be obviously some pretty tight timelines, but we'd be more than willing to get that and share that with everyone. We'll send it out by the first, put a week or so response on it, and we'll share the responses with the full
Great.
Board.
Great.
All right, so I think I've hit this one enough, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Estes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now move on to...
Mr. Chairman,
there's
a question.
Yes,
right. Are there any restrictions on what these funds can be used for as the types of projects?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ellis, great question. Basically, the only thing these funds cannot be used for is maintenance.
Anyone else? Okay. Ms. Thomas, federal reauthorization.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Oh, put the wrong thing in. Today, I just want to go over with you all the status of the reauthorization plan, or lack thereof at this point. I'm just going to kind of talk about where we are and where we need to go and what needs to happen to get us there moving forward. Safety Lou was a six-year authorization bill passed in August 2005. It was a $286 billion authorization with $244 billion of that guaranteed. It was about $193 billion for highways, $45 billion for public transportation, and $6 billion for safety purposes. Virginia's estimated highway apportionment out of Safety Lou was about $4.7 billion over the 6 years. Safety Lou expired September 30th of 2009, and we have had 7 extensions since that time. The current extension expires on September 30th of this year. We've got a few months left. So what happens? So we get to a new reauthorization bill. Typically what happens is that the administration will draft a bill and find a sponsor in the House. Once that happens, the committees of jurisdiction in the House and the Senate will take up their own versions of the bill through amendments. In the House, House Transportation Infrastructure has primary jurisdiction over the bill, and House Ways and Means would write any revenue provisions. So if there's any new revenue sources or changes, House Ways and Means would take that. In the Senate, we have Environment and Public Works has jurisdiction over highways. Commerce, Science, and Transportation deals primarily with safety. And Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs is concerned with transit. I'll note here that Senator Warner is a member of both Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, and he's also on the Subcommittee for Surface Transportation and Merchant Marine Infrastructure Safety and Security from Virginia. So, once the committees take up the bills and mark them up, they'll go to the full House, and then the full houses will take up the bills. Typically, they mark them up further or amend them further, and then they go into conference committee. So it's really similar to the legislative process here in Virginia. So where are we today? Back in February, the Obama administration released a proposal in conjunction with its FY 2012 budget proposal. This proposal is not a bill. It's essentially a broad outline of the administration's policy priorities and what they'd like to see. In the bill, they proposed a $556 billion six-year reauthorization. Of that, about $336 billion is for highways, about $119.2 billion for transit, close to $53 billion for rail. They've also proposed $30 billion to capitalize the National Infrastructure Bank, which I'll talk about a little more in a minute. $12.3 billion for motor carrier safety and national highway traffic safety. $2 billion for national infrastructure investments. National infrastructure investments is a program similar to TIGER and TIGER 2. And then also $3.4 billion for grants and aids to the Federal Aviation Administration. That $556 billion six-year total includes $50 billion upfront in fiscal year 2012 for certain highway, transit, rail, and airport programs. Of that $50 billion, the administration is proposing $450 million for Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, or TIFIA. They do not propose any additional funding over the remainder of the 6 years. It also proposes $25 billion for critical highway infrastructure in 2012. This is a new program, and the idea is that this program will be used to fund maintenance and improvement to highways and bridges on the enhanced national highway system. There's no details of what that enhanced NHS is. But in any case, this program is modeled somewhat after the ARRA funding and is proposed to be funded at 100% federal share. The balance of the $50 billion upfront would go to other highway programs like cross-border transportation, which would apply to Mexican and Canadian border projects, some transit projects, some rail, and then the two figures shown above for FAA and national infrastructure investments are also funded out of that $50 billion upfront. The administration's proposal also would consolidate basically 55 highway programs into only 5 programs. The National Highway Program would be comprised of basically the existing major transfer or core transportation programs here in Virginia that we receive funds for, interstate maintenance, national highway system, bridge funds, and the surface transportation program. According to the budget document, this program would be formula-based but would also include performance measures, which would be somewhat new. There are no details on what those formulas are at this time, so can't tell how exactly that would impact Virginia. Also, according to the President's budget, the federal and state shares under this program would be 80% and 20% respectively. So for some programs, like interstate maintenance, that's a bit of a change. It also creates a national safety improvement, highway safety improvement program, which is an already existing program. Creates a livable communities program out of existing transportation enhancements, CMAC, scenic byways, creates a research, technology, and education pot out of state planning and research funds, as well as Highways for Life, and the remainder is a federal allocation program, which is federal land funds and certain emergency relief funds. Another cornerstone of the administration's proposal is that it creates a transportation trust fund out of the existing highway trust fund. And this new fund would have accounts for highways, transit, high-speed passenger rail, and the National Infrastructure Bank. According to the proposal, the existing gas tax revenues would fund the highway and transit accounts, but it does not identify a revenue source for the high-speed passenger rail account or the National Infrastructure Bank on the long term. So really, what that means is that without additional revenues, this proposal could have the effect of shifting some highway user fees or additional highway user fees from highways to transit. The administration's proposal includes a placeholder revenue increase of $231 billion over 6 years. There's no revenue source identified for that.
All right, so I just want to make sure, just stop there beyond the fact that it's very unusual they're doing this in the budget. They are proposing in that budget a $556 billion program, of which they haven't identified how they're going to spend, fund $231 billion of it.
Correct. The language,
which is about 40-something percent of the program. They haven't said where the revenues are going to come from.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. There's language included in the budget proposal that says the administration is committed to working with Congress to identify a revenue source. And then the other item in the administration's proposal is that it would propose to treat transportation programs as mandatory spending. That's similar to how Social Security and certain entitlement programs are treated currently. This sort of runs concurrent with an amendment to House rules in January that repealed a requirement that annual appropriations bills fund surface transportation at the level authorized in the bill. So, say, FILU guaranteed funding at $244 billion, And that House rule essentially is what locked in that guaranteed funding level and ensured that Congress appropriated that amount of money over the 6 years. The repeal of this rule essentially means that an appropriations committee could cut funding, and so that sort of speaks to planning in the future and making sure that we have funds available for the six-year program. In terms of the committee progress, we actually had a little change last night. The House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee up until yesterday had only conducted listening sessions, and then at some point late last night they released a document they called Views and Estimates of the FY 2012 Budget. It's essentially a rebuttal of the administration's proposal that I just went over on the previous slide. I'll just briefly outline some of the items in this Views and Estimates document. It says they do not support the proposed $556 billion funding level. However, the committee does support programs and policies that promote innovative financing and public-private partnerships. They also want to accelerate project delivery. They also want to explore ways to better leverage existing revenues, so expansion of TIFIA and the railroad infrastructure finance programs. They'd also like to eliminate programs that are no longer in the federal interest and consolidate programs, so that's similar to the Obama administration. And the committee does not support treatment of transportation funds as mandatory in the long run. So Chairman Mica has publicly stated that he wants a six-year bill that lives within the means of the Highway Transportation Fund. And the committee is likely to have a bill sometime in April. The chairman said in a news release I saw last night that he'd like to have the House bill on the floor done by the Memorial Day recess. On the Senate side, not much has been done. They've had hearings, and they too expect a bill later this spring or early summer. That kind of brings us full circle. In order to get a bill done before the presidential campaign season heats up by August, they're going to have bills out of committee and on their floors by the summer recess. So as it says here, the campaign will be underway by late summer or early fall, so there won't be a whole lot of time to pay attention to transportation or much of anything else at that point. And just a reminder of other items that Congress is working on through the remainder of FY 2011, which is in September. They still have to deal with FY 2011 appropriations. We've been working under continuing resolutions since October 1st of last year. And just another note, the House passed a CR yesterday continuing funding through April 8th, and the Senate is expected to also support that CR. Just a note, because we have an authorization for transportation, if funding does expire, transportation will continue to operate. There could be a slowdown in reimbursements, but states will be reimbursed once the government has an appropriations bill or a CR. Congress is also working on the question of the debt ceiling. They have to deal with FY12 appropriations before October 1st and then reauthorization. So a number of competing items in a short timeline.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Richard.
How does this affect our bottom line? I mean, most of the money does not come from appropriations. It comes from the other process, right? I mean, the funds that come out of the authorizing committees are not appropriated, right? They're kind of like entitlements. Will we run out of these monies? And if so, at one time, if they don't reauthorize this thing, when can we start running out of federal money if they don't take action?
I would say that I don't believe there's been an instance where Congress has not continued extending transportation.
Have like they do on appropriations, just kind of continue the current program at the current rate, essentially, is what you would expect would happen.
We've been doing that we've been doing that since September of 2009, so
nothing new.
We would expect that to continue to happen.
And the funds have stayed the same, right?
Essentially, slightly higher than FY10 levels, but basically at the highest end of FY10.
Do they have to act to do that? Do they have to pass something?
They do have to pass a bill that contains language extending the current authorization.
So we're not in danger of running out of federal funds. We're just not going to get any new ones. Probably, right?
That would be correct.
Okay.
I think, actually, Mr. Lawson, could you explain the difference between apportionment, allocations, and an obligated authority?
I'll give it a shot.
In 30 seconds or less.
30 seconds or less, okay. The federal apportionments are the formula-based dollars that are provided by way of a highway authorization. Your allocated funds are those that they kind of discretionary pots of dollars that are usually distributed through annual bills, not part of the annual appropriation bills, budget bills, versus through the legislative transportation.
Those are earmarks, right?
Well, and some, not necessarily all earmarks, because some of them are allocated because they are through the discretionary programs. In terms of obligation authority, that's where that is the amount of their apportionment that we can actually contract with the federal government to go spend in a given year. So while our apportionment may be $1 billion, they may tell us that we can only obligate $900 million this year just on new projects. It's not directly connected, but the obligation authority process is Congress's way of kind of controlling cash flow of the transportation program.
And they do that in the appropriations acts.
Correct.
So we think we'll get the same obligation then, probably, or very similar to what we had.
What they have continued on, as Wendy said, is that continuing resolutions that we've been operating under since the current legislation expired in 2009 has kept us going at basically the 2009 level of funding.
But we should not expect, what the issue really is, it just happened, is that they had been supplementing the highway trust fund with general revenues to keep it whole to its to our allocations.
Yeah, because current federal program is about $42 billion a year, highway program, and you're looking at revenues of about $37 billion a year.
So what may end up happening is they may end up, and it's clear from Chairman Mica and others, that they're going to try to make the highway trust fund stay within its means, and meaning that it only spent $37 million a year. Now that obviously would have an impact on us, but they're also looking at there's other money that is going to a lot of other purposes other than specifically transportation that they'll potentially end up eliminating. So we don't know what the impact's going to be actually in our program yet.
That's true.
It's going to be a fun year if they come up with a bill. Any other questions? Excellent. Thank you very much. Corridors of statewide significance. Ms. Boyle.
Hi, I'm Marcia Fiedel. I work for VDOT. I'm actually here representing the Office of Environmental Planning and Investment. I'm filling in for Deputy Secretary David Tarr. As you can tell, I'm not as tall as him and I'm not as loud as him, but I'll do my best to fill his shoes. So I'm going to start with providing the purpose or the objective of this presentation, and that's to provide information on the corridors of statewide significance. We'll talk about the concept development, the legislative mandates related to this, the identification process and selection criteria, and the current corridors that we have. And then lastly, I'll close with identifying where we're going next with the corridor statewide significance. For background, the concept of identifying the most critical travel corridors in the Commonwealth was introduced in the previous multimodal transportation plan, B-Trans 2025. At that time, they were called Multimodal Investment Networks, or MIMs. And the MIMs were identified as projects that depend on each other, like a bus needs a road, projects that connect two or more modes, like a road connects to an airport, projects that might be substitutable, like a rail line in lieu of a road, or projects that are multimodal by definition, something like HOV lanes. And from a process perspective, this provides a mechanism for ensuring multimodal solutions. An illustrative list of these projects is included here. The original MANs were both corridors, networks, and specific functions or efforts. This was a somewhat abstract naming convention, and while many of these can be easily visualized, they aren't all as easily understandable to the common person. Some of these multimodal investment networks, such as I-81 or 29, Route 29, are pretty relatively understandable. Others were less easy to communicate, such as the Colville's access or emergency transportation. And this was the Commonwealth's first real attempt to identify multimodal transportation networks that were of significance to the state. And it was a good first start, but as we can all agree, there's always room for improvement. So as it sometimes happens, legislation steps in to help us with some direction. The main concept identified the facilities that were most critical to the multimodal transportation for the Commonwealth was well received. In House Bills 2019 and 2009, General Assembly required several requirements for the multimodal transportation planning. They identified that the long-range transportation plan, V-Trans, was to set forth an assessment of needs for all corridors of statewide significance, and the assessment is to consider all modes of transportation. The CTB is to designate the corridors of statewide significance, not constrained by local, district, regional, or modal plans. We went from MENs to corridors. The naming of the MENs was to avoid the perception of being any kind of modal specific. And I think when you talk about I-81, you immediately think about the road there, you think about the truck traffic and those lines. But there's also a parallel railway facility that we don't need to forget. And there's also airport facilities up and down that corridor that serve. And there's also inland ports available. So there's other modes. There's other facilities that need to be considered in the corridors of statewide significance. So as defined in V-Trans 2035, a corridor of statewide significance is an integrated multimodal system of transportation facilities that connects activity centers within and without the Commonwealth and promotes the easy movement of people, services, goods, and vital to the economic prosperity of the state. If you were to draw the corridors on the map, you would use a broad brushstroke. These are not detailed lines. These are wide corridors. They include parallel facilities. So in free transit, the corridors of statewide significance are broadly drawn and include other modal facilities, highways, rail lines, transit service, port facilities, and airports. Additionally, parallel roadway facilities are also included in addition to the major interstate or U.S. highway along those corridors. V-Trans 2035 examined the characteristics and deficiencies of significant statewide corridors and identified strategies to improve movement through and between the corridors. The improvement strategies included things like focusing on multimodal solutions to moving people, services, and goods, and identifying high-priority multimodal solutions within the corridor that would be given increased consideration over a single-mode option in individual modes and plans and programs. The identification of the corridor statewide significance was a lengthy and involved process. There were numerous meetings with the Deputy Secretary, with multimodal technical committee, with the MPO executive directors and planners, PDC executive directors and their planners. This was a huge outreach effort and a very collaborative and cooperative effort. But this was done through an iterative process. And this working group developed the corridor statewide significance criteria, applied the criteria, and identified the corridors. Further, the methodology and results of the working group were vetted through a series of public meetings. And finally, the corridors were accepted by the CTB in late December 2009. Let's talk a little bit about the criteria. There are four criteria for a corridor of statewide significance. The first is that it involves a multimodal modes, highway, rail, intermodal, or interregional transit, airport, port, or as a freight corridor and extends beyond the individual region. The second criteria, it connects regions, states, major activity centers. The third criteria provides a high level or volume of transport. And that was further defined by identifying a Class 1 railroad, interregional public transportation stations, interstate NHS facilities, a major port, major freight corridor, a commercial and or reliever airports, economic development, major shipping channels, gateways of national or international significance, or state bicycle or interregional trail. And then the fourth criteria, was it provides a unique statewide function and or addresses statewide goals. So it could be an evacuation route or critical redundancy, security issues, the military access, could be a significant for tourism, a significant truck route, those kinds of significance. And to be identified as a corridor of statewide significance, these corridors had to meet all these four criteria. And these are our corridors of statewide significance. We have 11 across the state. This slide shows the corridors along with the airports, railways, ports, and county lines. As you'll see, these are really broad brush strokes. These are wide. It's difficult to see some things like the railroads and airports because they're inside those corridors, so they don't show up very clearly in the white space.
Question.
Yes.
Ms. Garza.
As I read the map, though, there is between 81 and 95 no significant north-south corridor to Dulles Airport. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
So of these corridors, there's the first. I'll start at the top. Sometimes it's hard to read these slides. The south side corridor is the US 58 in dark green along the southern border of the state. The Seminole corridor, US 29, is pink running along the heart of the state. The western mountain corridor is I-77 bright yellow in the southwest corner of the state. The crescent corridor is I-81, the goldenrod, and runs along the mountain ridge of the Commonwealth. The heartland corridor, Route 460, is navy blue running east-west through the state. The coastal corridor, US 17, is royal blue running along the east coast of the Commonwealth. The eastern shore corridor, US 13, is seafoam green and goes from North Carolina through Hampton Roads and up through the eastern shore. The east-west corridor, I-64, is bright red and runs east-west through the heart of the state. The Washington to North Carolina corridor, I-95, is bright green. It's more inland along the eastern side of the state. The Northern Virginia Connector is I-66. It's plumb and connects from Washington to the Crescent or the I-81 corridor. And lastly, the 11th corridor is the North Carolina to West Virginia corridor, US 220. It runs from North Carolina through Roanoke and into into Western Virginia. These are the 11 corridors statewide significance. And there is a summary and the background development for each of the corridors of statewide significance. My last slide really goes to what's coming up next for you. Upcoming in the process for the corridors of statewide significance, the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment and the Multimodal Advisory Committee are working to develop a methodology to prioritize the next corridor of statewide significance to be studied. And they're also developing a methodology to identify possible segmentations of the corridor statewide significance into effective pieces for study. Second, the segmentation of the corridor statewide significance and applying the prioritization methodology. And third, they'll prioritize the corridor statewide significance to identify the next corridor of statewide significance for study. And these first three items, 1 through 3, are currently under development. Item number 4, these three items will be presented to the CTV at the next meeting in April 2011. And then our last thing to do here on the next steps is initiate the next quarter of statewide significance study.
Question.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Lonergan.
Marcia, since we adopted these corridors of statewide significance, we've had several new members of the board join. And could you just summarize briefly what we use these corridors for? I mean, how do we take what you just explained and put it into decision-making here? How does that work?
Well, the intent of the corridor statewide significance is really to show these are the priority corridors for this state. These are the things that for economic vitality, for commuter traffic, for traveling throughput to and from activity centers within the state as well as beyond the state. These are the significant corridors. So this is really meant to help us identify what are the critical recommendations for improvement to these corridors, and then to prioritize those in our funding process.
Okay.
Well, I'm just trying to get at the fact that, I mean, in my case, the Richmond District, it's really pretty simple. I-95, for example, is a principal corridor. We didn't have to designate it as such, per se, to understand that, but I'm glad we did. But I don't recall ever having a discussion that says, because this is a corridor of statewide significance, we've got to do this, that, and the other thing. And maybe all that takes place within the bowels of VDOT somewhere, and we only get to see what we get to decide upon. And I'm just trying to figure out how you get from this 30,000-foot altitude view of the Commonwealth and its corridors to actual decision-making. That's what I'm trying to hone in on.
Right, and I'd probably say that because our actual programming decision-making is separated among the modes, this is an effort to come together and look at the whole corridor from a multimodal perspective to see what needs to be done in the corridor and what takes significance. So you would prioritize what the improvements are, and then it would be expected for those modes to go back and program those improvements.
Okay, this is probably a longer discussion for another time.
Mr. Goulding.
Chairman, I think I can help answer Mr. McCarthy's question. As part of our Route 29 subcommittee that we formed on that corridor, what we realized was there wasn't just potential disagreement about specific projects or specific plans, but there was really the need to have a process where our planning process better interfaced with local and regional planning processes. So the investments, whether they were made primarily by the state or by the locality, actually would further that overall plan. It's meant to give guidance, I think, more than instruction. And for we still have the other pieces of our decision-making intact, what the budget allows, what our own priorities are, what federal fund matching requires, what local land use plans contain. All those are, it doesn't supersede any of those existing ones. It simply gives us, as you said, a chance at least to share what the multimodal plan should be for a corridor going forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Rich.
Not being totally familiar with how this was all done, I appreciate Mr. McCarthy's questions. So essentially what you had some of our top experts look at, with all kinds of data, look at the situation, look at the whole Commonwealth, and then they made this recommendation essentially, right, as to what was strategic, or what do we call these things, corridors of statewide significance. And this was done, a couple years ago?
Correct.
And none of those experts saw a need to add any additional north-south corridors in the northern part of the Commonwealth at that time. Is that correct?
This is all that was identified at that time.
All right. So they have examined this recently, and none of the experts came up with that impression. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman.
Mr. Lonenbach, and then come back.
One thing following this, I noticed on page 11, but one of the criteria, of course, is evacuation route or critical redundancy. And along that line, it seems to me as though, and this is probably part of the process, and I'm not grasping it, but evacuation routes, especially with what has gone on in the past with hurricanes, terrorist threats, different things like that, should be the primary decision-making in some of these areas as far as corridors, because if that is done correctly, then the tourism access, the economic access of plant development, moving product from Hampton Roads, that type of thing, should flow more easily. And I know we've had some discussion about the concern with the bottlenecks in Hampton Roads and being able to bring people out quickly if there was an evacuation need. I don't know how much of that process has gone into the thinking, and I hope it's been a lot. But I would think that that's some of the things that we ought to concentrate on, because if we get, especially in the situation with Hampton Roads, if we get an evacuation need and can't move the people out, it's going to be a severe problem. And I would think, again, as I said, if you plan these well, then you're going to be able to move your product out of Hampton Roads as well as people. But it needs to be kind of a good coordinated process, and I'm hoping that's what's part of the thing now, as opposed to some of these other corridors that seem to be more related to economics, moving people from one section of a state to another, north, south, east, west, whatever, they may not be as critical. It may be good from an economic development point, but they may not tie in well with what we need to do with some of these emergency concerned aspects.
Yes, Mr.
I just wanted to second what Mr. Lauterbacher said. I was in Washington when 9/11 hit. And really, the only way to get out of there was on 66 for me to go home, for folks in Virginia to get out of there. And that thing was impassable. It was just unbelievable. One question I have is, in order to get federal funds, do you have to be on this type of thing? Or how does this impact federal funding?
It doesn't really impact federal funding. It's just a state designation.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, yes. No.
Yes. Is this a moving target as such? So can corridors be added, you know, as we go along, or is this set in stone?
Nothing is ever set in stone. We're continuously reevaluating, readjusting things. The initial intent for the reconsideration, of course, that was significant, is in the initial V-Trans process. So when that starts back up, which will be later this year, that'll be one of the things they'll look at.
Mr. Bowie.
Thank you. A few minutes ago, Mr. Rich asked whether the experts had considered another north-south corridor at the time. There was a review committee of board members, Dr. Davis, Mr. Coulmay, and myself were on that committee, chaired by Kenneth White. And at the time, the Deputy Secretary, Ralph Davis, and his staff members were in that group with considerable discussion about whether there should, Mr. Coulmay especially, raised the issue whether there's another corridor needed north-south in that area. And I think that the ultimate solution that was made by this committee before it came back with the recommendation to the entire board was there will be other corridors to be added later, and that this probably should be one of them. And I think that it was not a decision by the experts that that corridor was not needed. It just was not at that time put in, and I think that Mr. Coulmay made a pretty good case at the time that there should be a further consideration of adding that corridor to the...
But the experts looking at it without any political consideration couldn't find a need for it.
That's not true.
That Mr.
Chairman, that's not true.
Yeah,
Dr.
Davis, watch it.
I'm not making a statement.
No, just Dr. Davis. Oh, well.
I think one of the considerations for the selection of the corridors was the looking at the corridors that were in place, the roadways in place, with the idea that as the future evolves and as the process evolves, and the prioritization of setting these corridors would create the atmosphere for additional corridors as the population changed or as roads were built or as the plans with the comprehensive plans with the localities through working with VDOT developed and raised the need for the additional roadways. So part of this really is working with localities and their comprehensive plans and the master planning that we would do on the corridors as to what was the appropriate access, what was the appropriate development, what were the improvements, the widening, the multimodal components, safety, and those things that evolved over time. But they were definitely critical to the state as a whole for transferring people and goods north, south, east, west, and through the state and across other states.
Thank you. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If you would indulge me, going back a bit to Mr. McConkie's original question, I feel eminently competent to explain what the how the corridors came to be, how you get to be one. But a lot of times taxpayers off the street ask me questions. They want like a simple answer. And I want to make sure I'm on the right wavelength here
and what it actually means to be a corridor of significance. So am I correct that, simply put, it means they get priority funding?
That's the intent.
No. I guess they get priority planning.
Thinking, yeah. That's
where
we're thinking.
Yes, I think that's the
point. Yeah, is that correct? I mean, it just means we look at them a little bit more.
In terms of linking.
And they get a special little green, little light, a little line. What color will you make if we add new ones? Can we purple or? Okay. I'm sorry.
Part of it comes down to long-range planning, because working on the corridors, we would be creating master plans that would be incorporated and worked into localities' comprehensive plans and our long-range planning documents. V-Trans 2035 into visions for, and from those we would look to come up with segments and projects of improvement along those corridors, and those would get funded in the program as you link your planning to your programming and to project delivery. So it's part of the process in terms of planning prioritization.
So am I correct in the simple explanation would be to get planning priority?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
That was the concept and vision.
I'm sorry.
From a definite multimodal perspective.
Mr. Coulombe?
Mr. Chairman, I just thought it might be useful to quickly review, say, the I-95 corridor, which everybody understands is very important. It's not meant that the I-95 corridor is more important or less important than US 13 or US 220 or whatever. They're measured differently. But within the 95 corridor, I think it's clear, the briefing that we got about the population growth, for example, almost two-thirds of the population growth going to occur in that corridor over the next 25 years, is, remember the consultant, for those who were here, said, if we try to make 95 handle that additional demand alone, we'll have a 24-lane road. Well, obviously, we laughed at the time because that's absurd. So the key for this corridor planning process was to say, what else needs to happen in 95, a corridor? And that includes extension of VRE, for example. It includes additional Amtrak service, potentially high-speed passenger rail. What we discovered was the answers for whether it was passengers, freight, commuters, or whatever tended to be the same. We needed to broaden the mix of transportation services in the corridor and give people better choices so they could make better decisions about how to move back and forth. At the same time, we were very mindful that development is continuing to occur in that corridor, whether we responded to it with additional transportation capacity or not. The expansion at Quantico, for example, was going to happen whether we planned for it or not. The growth down to through Spotsylvania was happening whether we were planning that or not. The U.S. Census Bureau is actually identifying a commuter labor market movement from Hanover now into Northern Virginia. So whether we see it or want to acknowledge it or not, these things were happening. And it was how better to begin to see what our options were there. And they came up differently. It wasn't just add a lane or a new interchange. It was add the third track through Quantico that allowed us additional flexibility to expand VRE and so forth. So that's really what the corridors are meant to do, not play off against one another, but actually to facilitate planning within the corridors so those corridors that we know are important actually work. And that's really the spirit of this whole exercise, this whole intent of continuing to look at and update both corridors and plans within corridors.
And I'm sorry, when we say this gives priority planning, it's priority multimodal planning.
Right.
So it's everything from roads to bike paths to transit to whatever. It's everything. Sorry. Now, Mr.
It was never meant to be, at least in discussions, I was in a static document. It was a document or a planning tool that as things evolved around the state. In fact, besides this one, I remember we talked about 64 to Raleigh, but, you know, that clearly hasn't been the case for that. But and then you're right, the population we saw, and one of the facts that has proved to be is that Northern Virginia grew at a much faster rate than the rest of the state. whether that's good, bad, or different, it's the facts. And that was one of the things that was driving our looking at these corridors of statewide significance, at least one of the big factors I remember. So,
Mr. Chairman, there's one other thing that was interesting in our discussion some years ago when we did this. If you look at the northern portion of the triangle there, you'll see there's only really one way or two ways to get out of Virginia. And if you look at all the roads coming in to that portion where the population base is, some logic would say that that blue line ought to go on out of Virginia, and the purple one going across up there should go on out of Virginia because they meet places that are in other states. But because of political reasons, which we were very aware of in those discussions, they're white instead of having a color, letting the population move through Virginia effectively because people don't want them to go through that area in past discussions. But with population trends and economic necessities for the Commonwealth, that's just a couple of examples of where we're going to have to discuss how we're going to get people through those corridors. And there are a number of other places just like that. If you look at these, you see the ones going across, the ones going up, it tells you what we need to discuss and try to come to some compromise with the population centers as to how we're going to get people through those areas.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McCarthy.
I don't want to belabor this, but I guess I'd feel a lot more comfortable about the use of these corridors if they were tied to funding somehow or another, because the fact is there's much more money for road building and maintenance than there is for rail. And in the 95 corridor, just about everyone agrees the solution is more rail service and higher speed rail service, and extending from Northern Virginia, the VRE, down into Richmond, and so on and so forth. And yet, when we try to come up with a plan for rail, we're told we don't have any money, or it'll take 30 years to develop the money to do this. But in the meanwhile, we somehow find money to do all kinds of road projects. And I'm just saying, if we're really going to use this as a multimodal planning process, then somehow the table's got to be leveled among the funding sources and the funding spending that we do in this. Otherwise, we're going to have to emphasize highways because that's where the money is. And that's not a multimodal solution, as my colleague pointed out, that you're, 24 lane wide, 95 doesn't make any sense. More rail service makes more sense, but that's not where we're investing the money. And consequently, I wonder, I'll just put it as plainly as I can, I'm not sure why we get excited about corridors of statewide significance, because in fact we don't seem to use them because they're not tied to any funding decisions that we make.
Can't disagree with that. which goes along, well, I mean...
You don't want me to comment on that?
I mean, this is at the heart of some of the issues it's going to take us a long time to get to, and that is backing up our plans with money. I mean, and focusing, particularly at the state level, on the V-Trans report and what we say are what's important to us is not always where we're putting our money, at least. But generally, I mean, I realize you can broadly define those terms because you look at improvements in corridors. But it is, Mr. McCarthy is correct. So, any other questions? Thank you very much. Off to rail industrial excess funds, Murfitt Stone, Director Drake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and I do need Carol's help. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we have an application from Smurfit Stone Corporation to get you to the first slide to show you the location in Henrico, in Henrico County. Smurfit Stone is a paperboard and paper-based, paper-based packaging manufacturer in Henrico. They've received other incentives from the state, Virginia Jobs Investment Program, Virginia Investment Partnership Grant as well. Cost of the project is just over $436,000. $294,458 is recommended. And what this will do is connect 410 foot of track as part of Smurfit Stone's expansion. This also serves their two paper mills. One is in Hopewell, one is in West Point. Their operations cannot begin until this track is constructed because of the size of their shipments. They have to go by rail and not by truck. So I do want you to know that work has already begun, and costs will be incurred prior to us signing this agreement. Rail service will be provided by CSX. Local capital investment is 32. Wait a minute, I must be. It's not moving, Carol. Local capital investment is $32 million and retention of 150 jobs in Henrico County. This will also enable about 520 carloads of shipments, which takes 1,500 to 2,000 truckloads a year off of the road. The projects have been evaluated using our criteria. Carol, will this one work? Where the other one won't? It's stopped moving. And it is recommended for funding. In this particular project, of course, total project cost $436,458, recommended $294,458, and also local participation in addition to the $32 million is $142,000. So our recommendation is to approve the project.
Yes.
I don't know anything about the project. Just fill me in a little bit. What's the are they not connected at all to the rail as it stands now? What's the $32 million being spent on? And is that $400 just for the rail part?
Let's see. It's a the Henrico County facility represents a capital investment of $32 million. My assumption, and I wish Kevin were here. He's had something pretty big come up that he couldn't be here. Smurfit Stone is already a Virginia corporation, but this, I believe, is an expansion of what they're doing. So they're connecting to the CSX line, which if I could go back, it would show you how close they are. But you've got the paperwork to see it's very close. It's 410 feet of track to connect them to CSX.
But what's the? Does anybody know anything about the project?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a pretty good deal for 410 feet of.
What's the $32 million being spent on?
$32
million? Yeah,
we're not spending
that.
No.
What's the
asset value?
That's the asset.
That's their capital, their facility that's being built for all of this. We're only doing the rail connection.
Well, I understand that. But yeah, what's the facility? Is it there or not there?
I think it's there.
It's there already, yeah.
And they're expanding it.
They're expanding.
$32 million to expand it.
And they're creating jobs.
Okay.
And they need one of these connections. And
to avoid truck.
You know, just delightful.
No, I'm for it. I just didn't know what it was. I think it was like
an existing plant that is expanding and needs a rail connection.
Any other questions for the director?
Just one clarification is KMC Chemical Corporation.
That was a mistake. No. It is Smurf Stone, Smurfit Stone Corporation. I think it was fixed on the overhead, but we can't get it to move. Thank you. So, Carol, how do I escape it now?
Any other questions?
If it'll move. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Mr. Drake, thank you very much. All right, can we take a 10-minute break? You want 15 minutes. 12:30? 12:30. We're going to start the main meeting at 12:30. Thank you all very much.